The Spitfire is a great British icon. It helped win the Battle of Britain and defeat Nazi Germany in the Second World War.
This beautiful bird was a bird of ultimate destruction to the Germans, which is why we won the war.
But the Spitfire was more than just a fighter plane. It was Britain's eyes in the sky. Painted blue and armed with cameras rather than guns and bombs, spy planes took tens of millions of aerial photographs.
The story of air intelligence was one of the most important stories, I think, of the war.
A crack team of sleuths at RAF Medmenham pieced together a vast jigsaw of clues from these photos. But what the Germans didn't realize was that they weren't just working in two dimensions. The photo detective's secret weapon was a simple stereoscope, which brought to life every contour of the enemy landscape in perfect 3D.
In 3D, the first thing, you can get height. Also, at the same time, you can measure very effectively, too, the width.
Battlefield Europe was recreated on the viewing tables of RAF Medmenham, probing every hillside, railway line, ship, building, and most importantly, every unidentified new structure.
Two photos slide together.
Modern computer graphics, based on the original World War II photographs, show just how the Nazi world was analysed in 3D.
Moving over 3D terrain.
You had to have a real terrier-like approach to sort of, we'll find out what this is. Come hell or high water.
RAF Medmenham's finest hour would come with Operation Crossbow, when it hunted down and identified Hitler's mysterious and deadly new V weapons. Rockets and pilotless drones, unprecedented, baffling, and potentially capable of swinging the war.
In today's terminology, the V weapons were the first weapons of mass destruction.
Had he been able to deploy as many as he originally intended, it would almost certainly have destroyed London.
Working night and day, they saved thousands and thousands of lives.
One of the rockets launches into the sky. BBC, Operation Crossbow.
The heroic tales of World War II are legend. Tales of Battle of Britain fighter aces or the brilliant boffins of Bletchley Park. But there is another story, a little-known story which deserves to join this Hall of Fame. Danesfield House, 60 kilometres west of London, was home to RAF Medmenham. Here, a highly skilled group of photo interpreters, or PIs, played a vital role in tracking, exposing, and crushing the German war machine.
It was an A1 source of information. The photo interpreters were providing not only up-to-date information, but accurate information.
The work that was done was absolutely vital, as vital as Bletchley.
80% of British intelligence came from photo reconnaissance and photo interpretation.
I think it was a German general who said that a country with the best intelligence will win. And we provided intelligence.
10 million of these wartime photographs survive, many in 3D, and are today kept in Edinburgh.
Inside a research room.
Researcher Alan Williams is helping Wing Commander Mike Mockford and Major Chris Halsall, who both worked as photo interpreters after the war, trace the original images which helped defeat the Nazis.
Nothing moved in Europe which we did not photograph, and it was absolutely critical to the Allied success in the Second World War.
Without air reconnaissance, it is difficult to imagine how we could have possibly achieved the results we did.
A reconstruction.
Air reconnaissance took a great leap forward in 1940 with the creation of a specialist wing of the RAF, the Photographic Reconnaissance Unit. The secret of its success was transforming the Starfighter, the Spitfire, into the best spy plane in the world. Jimmy Taylor flew reconnaissance missions in a Spitfire, like this one.
It was a superb aeroplane, absolutely wonderful. We were very privileged. We were flying the fastest aeroplane, the most beautiful aeroplane, no guns sticking out, spoiling the outline. You could say it was like a butterfly. We had the best job in the Air Force, in my opinion.
Jimmy Taylor, reconnaissance pilot.
That aircraft was an exceptional piece of equipment. It could reach Berlin. It filmed the entire Ruhr in one mission.
A remote lakeside.
Photo reconnaissance helped forge the special relationship in intelligence gathering between Britain and America. It meant US Air Force pilot John S. Blythe could achieve his boyhood dream of flying a Spitfire. His war was documented in this rare color footage shot at Mount Farm Airfield.
My job was as a photo reconnaissance pilot. I loved the Spitfire, and basically all around it was a wonderful airplane to fly. It had a good rate of climb, good maneuverability. I loved it. It had cameras, no guns.
The planes had no guns, but this lack of firepower didn't bother the pilots.
It's quite all right, actually, because cruising speed 360 miles an hour, and there weren't any aeroplanes in 1944 which could do that until the German jets came.
In the cockpit as the Spitfire takes off, then the plane climbing beneath a blue sky.
It's painted blue, this rather lightish grey blue, in order to camouflage it against the blue sky when it's flying at 30,000 feet, which was the optimum height for taking our photographs. The biggest enemy we had was that we might make a contrail, and it betrayed our position, and flak could come up, and equally the fighters.
The pilots were quite astonishing, out of this world. They had to navigate their way to their target on their own, looking out for interception, sometimes in difficult conditions.
The whole thing was a heart-stopping exercise, quite frankly. I think they were marvellous.
But the great thing was, when they found their target, they had to fly a level course, because if they weren't flying straight and level, it distorted the pictures.
They were the cream of the aircrew. You had to actually find your target, photograph it underneath you when you couldn't actually see it.
You'd have to get right over the target practically and roll over and see the target and then bring the airplane around and level out and fly straight and level while the cameras were turning.
It had five cameras, and one was fitted under each wing here and two in the fuselage. The cameras here, as you can see, it's a pretty big one, and that would have to be put through this hatch here and point down through one of these two portholes in the bottom of the fuselage. At 30,000 feet, you could take pictures of a man on a bicycle.
But interestingly, the first thing in the Spitfire that they heated was the camera, because they wanted good photographs. The pilot froze, basically.
If you're gone for 5 hours, you might be at a minus 50 degrees, and so cold that sometimes your knees, you could hardly bend them or anything.
Felt not too good having done it all unless they got the pictures back to us. And they did it day after day in very difficult conditions.
John S. Blythe, like all reconnaissance pilots, diced with death many times. Once, when his landing gear jammed, a moment that was caught on camera.
I felt kind of a thud. I came into land at Mount Farm, and I dropped the gear and the handle wouldn't move. I was sweating like everything, and I thought, I'm not going to get out of this one alive. Finally, after about an hour, I came in and touched down, and a wooden prop, which I've got a piece of it here, flew all to pieces.
Original footage shows him safely landed.
There's no point in asking a man to risk his life and then not getting every bit of information that the film contains.
Reconstruction as a Spitfire taxis on the runway.
The photos were analysed with scientific precision in three phases. The first, as soon as the plane had landed at the airfield.
They would look at the photographs, and if something needed immediate action within 24 hours, say, where the army had the shell or the air force had the bomb, some target, a bridge in Germany where the troops are crossing, that would be a very important target straight away.
The photographs were then printed on an industrial scale. An astonishing 36 million prints were made in the war.
They send all the more important photographs to Medmenham, for their interpreters there would then identify whether there was something that could be bombed or attacked in the next week or so, which was phase two, or whether it was a long-term thing about the German war effort and it contributed to phase three.
Medmenham was so many-sided, so many different things were going on. It's quite unbelievable. Most of us in our own little sections only knew what we were doing. But we were always impressed by the vast number of other things that were going on that we knew nothing about.
Well, I was in N section, which was the night photograph section. Flak and tracer and searchlights were all recorded on the run into the target. And it was just like an incredible mass of lines and waves and bursts of fire.
They recruited a lot of academics, and particularly academics who were accustomed to being precise and punctilious.
A lot of them were recruited from Oxford and Cambridge, mathematicians, geologists, archaeologists.
Interpreting photographs was not just an academic skill. It demanded creative minds and lateral thinking to find the devil in the detail.
The photos are studied.
One of Medmenham's most inspired moves was to recruit its talent from the Hollywood studios. Disney legend Ex Atencio, who later wrote Pirates of the Caribbean, was part of a large American contingent at Medmenham.
We had quite a few artists in our unit because we had an eye for detail. I was assigned to airfields. So that's how I became an expert on airfields.
We had Dirk Bogart as an actor. He was in the army section.
I thought he was a bit of a poseur and a dilettante. But I think he was quite a reasonable VI.
Something new had happened, too. They began to hire women. And at one time, they had about 150 women working as photo interpreters.
Generally, the women didn't fly. A lot of them were very hand-picked. Yes, I wasn't. A lot of them were.
The reconnaissance pilots and photo interpreters made a brilliant team. As the bombing offensive against German cities intensified, they played a vital role, not just in identifying targets, but also assessing the damage inflicted on the enemy.
The incredible amount of smoke rising and some very, very clear fires burning in the city. It was very necessary after every raid to analyse the damage. I mean, in simple terms, did you need to go back again? When you are at war, destroying the infrastructure and destroying the city is very important.
But what the PI saw was not always to the liking of the bomber crews, as Dino Brugioni found when he returned from apparently successful missions.
You would brag about it. Well, we put our bombs right on the target area. Well, what happened was a photo interpreter would look at it, and they'd say, you missed the target.
First of all, they deny it, and then they get mad, and then they want to blame Intel like it was their fault. But the imagery is truth.
And yet Churchill asked to see the photographs, and he sided with the photo interpreters.
A photo of Churchill, then original footage of planes in the sky.
In May 1942, the landmark 1,000 bomber raid was carried out against the German city of Cologne.
The scrambler rang the secret phone, and a voice said, is Cologne still there? And I said, yes, sir, there's quite a lot of it left. He said, send the photographs immediately to the cabinet war room. That was the great man himself.
Len Chance, PI.
Air reconnaissance was one thing. But what was so revolutionary was how Medmenham took an ordinary stereoscope, the equivalent of the 3D glasses used in modern-day cinemas, and turned it into an intelligence weapon which helped win the war.
The viewers they used were probably Victorian in origin, as part of a party game almost in the 19th century. So stereo is as old as the hills.
The original photos.
For it to work, pilots like Jimmy Taylor had to take the photos in a series of perfectly overlapping sequences.
These are the plots they made of my photographs. I'm amazed that these have been recovered. I haven't seen them myself. We had to make sure that when they were viewed by the photo interpreters, each of these pictures overlapped the other by 60%, because everything on the photograph would then stand up in three dimensions.
The Medmenham PIs became experts at interpreting this third dimension. 3D was as valuable a weapon as the bouncing bomb during the legendary Dam Busters raid against three dams in Germany. By applying modern computer graphics to the original photo from May 1943, you can see how a PI would have viewed it in 3D through a stereoscope.
We could take a photograph in 2D. It wouldn't show a thing. That was the advantage of 3D photography, is that you got the detail and looked into it. You get a wonderful impression of height. It's not just dead flat, and you can see the contours of the land.
People say, but obviously if you've got a photograph, you can see things. And indeed you can. But things aren't always what they appear to be.
3D allowed the PIs to see through a crafty German ploy to conceal one of their cruisers in this fjord.
Going offshore, there's this decoy and boom combined, where they lashed together tires in the water, joined them all up together and made them look like a ship floating in the water.
3D aerial photography had come of age. It was just as well, because Medmenham was about to be called upon to deliver its greatest victory in Operation Crossbow.
A Spitfire takes off.
The story begins in May 1942, when a British reconnaissance Spitfire took off from Benson Air Base and crisscrossed northern Germany. While flying over a remote island off the Baltic coast, something below caught the pilot's eye. It was an obscure place called Peenemünde.
And that was how they found Peenemünde, strictly by accident, because he saw they were making an airfield. Well, nothing attracts air intelligence like an airfield.
Lots of black and white photos.
And the only thing there that attracted anybody's attention were the three big concrete and earth circles.
An enlarged image.
Here we have the very first photograph of Peenemünde.
I think there was all sorts of conjecture as to what three circles were.
As a PI looking at those in isolation, my immediate reaction would probably be to think that they might be something to do with sewage, actually.
Colonel Robert S. Ehlers.
So, given the depressing nature of other things that they were doing at the time, the photo interpreters shelved those photos in 1942.
This could have been one of the greatest mistakes of World War II, because while the Allies had been honing their aerial reconnaissance skills, the Germans were busy too. Building a new generation of weapons of terrifying sophistication. The epicenter of their ominous weapons research was a purpose-built industrial complex at Peenemünde. The rockets and missiles they were developing there were the forerunners of the weapons that dominate our world today.
The Nazis spent a lot of money here in Peenemünde. This was the biggest research center in the world between 1936 and 1945.
I think the Germans were far, far ahead of us in terms of missile technology. They had some brilliant men.
Men like scientist Wernher von Braun were working on weapons that were so advanced that they were a complete mystery to the Allies.
A large vertical missile.
By 1942, their efforts were beginning to bear fruit. First, a V-1 cruise missile was successfully launched. And then on the 3rd of October, the Germans made one of the great breakthroughs in the history of science and of warfare when a V-2 rocket soared into the stratosphere at supersonic speed.
Vergeltungswaffen. Revenge weapons. And Hitler hoped that this big collection of new weapons that he was developing would be in place in time somehow to turn the tide.
The Nazis got once again hope to win the war.
Looking down from above, a simulation of a rocket taking off.
And the Allies knew nothing about their plans. Until a key breakthrough came at Trent Park Military Prison in March 1943, when British intelligence managed to bug a conversation between two German generals.
The British overheard two German generals captured in North Africa talking about this rocket, this future weapon that would soon be raining down on the British and might change the course of the war.
23rd of June 1943.
RAF Medmenham could be forgiven for overlooking the significance of the earlier photographs of Peenemünde. Now, they had a second chance, and at last something to go on. The spy planes were scrambled to scour Germany and northern France for any evidence they could get in camera.
Photographs of the surrounding area.
Thousands of photos were rushed back, and the interpreters were asked to find clues of long-range missiles that could be fired at Britain from France.
They were told to look for something queer, for a tube out of which could be squirted a missile. To ask a photo interpreter to do an analysis of a missile site that has never seen one before was asking a lot.
You were trained to know what would be normal to look at, so you had to have a sense of anomalies.
And there's a certain amount of detective work in looking at clues.
I always felt it was like doing a gigantic jigsaw puzzle.
And with the help of 3D, a PI managed to spot a tube on its side in one of the mysterious circles at Peenemünde.
All that was seen was a tube. To see the initial image was one thing. To work out what it was and what it could do was a very different one.
Well, I think there was a great fear about these things. I mean, where were they aimed at? What shape would they take? How would they attack us?
Now the real detective work began. In Edinburgh, the team is going back over the original photos that helped change the course of the war.
This is absolutely great. We've got here a photograph which shows two rockets.
It's a significant moment in history without any question when they saw this for the first time.
People, having looked at these, they said, well, how do they launch them? And it was then that they started looking back over imagery, and they eventually discovered the first one that was actually sticking up vertically and looked like a sort of big pole, really, sticking up in the air. And then we marked up where that first one is.
Yeah, pretty hard to see, but...
Yeah.
You can see the shadow of it there.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can learn more from the shadow than you can from the object, because you'll see the shadow on the ground and you can measure it.
The rocket stands in a field.
So the PIs were able to work out that the V2 rocket was an imposing 14 meters high.
Its shadow stretches out across the ground.
But there was a problem. Churchill's chief scientific advisor, Lord Cherwell, refused to believe the Germans had the technology to build rockets. It was all too new, like something from science fiction. Now RAF Medmenham needed something more than stereoscopes to make sense of the threat. It needed a step change in technology. The answer was the Wilt, a state-of-the-art photogrammetric machine used for land surveys. It alone could deliver the level of detail and precision needed to convince the doubters. But there was a shortage of Wilt machines in Britain. The only place to get them was Switzerland, but that was a neutral country. So one of the most daring missions of the war, led by squadron leader Ramsay Matthews, was launched to bring not one, but two new Wilt machines to Medmenham.
He managed to persuade a Swedish intermediary to buy two Wilt A6s and arranged for them to be shipped through Germany and moved them up to Sweden. They then, of course, had the problem of how to bring them back to UK. Squadron leader Ramsay was then flown out to Sweden, acquired these two machines, stripped them down. They were then put on board Mosquitoes. Of course, Mosquito isn't a big aircraft, and he was had to be strapped in the bomb bay of this with one of the Wilts.
Grainy black and white footage.
They took off and they got bounced by a German night fighter. The pilot wanted to slow up in a hurry, so opened up everything to slow it down suddenly, which included opening the bomb bay doors. In the excitement of getting away from the German night fighter, he then forgot to close the bomb bay doors. Flying right back across the North Sea, our poor old squadron leader was sitting in there nearly frozen to death. The whole episode showed how important these Wilts were considered.
The Wilt could now be used to get a greater understanding of Peenemünde.
In the machine, built into the optics, is a floating dot. The floating dot enables you to actually trace a contour or to measure precisely an object in length, width, and the height of an object. In the V-weapon saga, this particular machine was used to measure the buildings and the rocket test sites so that the models that were so vital in convincing the senior scientists that there were indeed a rocket development sites.
The precise measurements provided by the Wilt enabled the model makers to bring Peenemünde to life for the uninitiated. The model they made in 1943 is now locked away in the storerooms at the Imperial War Museum in Duxford.
Oh, right, so this is the one original surviving model of Peenemünde then?
Yeah, and it's in very good condition.
This is the first ballistic missile test site ever in the world.
It's perfect in almost every detail.
A modern computer fly-through of the model gives some idea of the sort of impression it would have made on Churchill and his war cabinet back in 1943.
They could come and study this, and it would have been accurate in every detail of measurement, and so they would have been able to size the missile against the construction building and the engine test site here.
Yeah.
I don't think the scientists at that time had any idea. In fact, there was a lot of skepticism about what it was.
And that, of course, was one of the arguments that Cherwell used,
that That's right.
We'd never produced one, so how could the Germans?
I think this is the classic, we can't do it, they can't do it. And that's one of the greatest intelligence mistakes anyone ever makes.
As the politicians bickered, spy planes monitoring northern France came back with more alarming photographs.
A map showing the Calais area.
Just a short hop across the channel.
They find bunkers, large bunkers. The bunkers didn't have any particular unique shape that you could determine what was in them.
They were huge, monstrous concrete structures.
Obviously, to start with, nobody knew what they were. They were so strange.
These mysterious bunkers became known to the PIs as the heavy sites. The heaviest of all was built in a quarry in a village called Vizanne, just 40 kilometers from the English Channel. Not all photographs were taken from the safety of 9,000 meters. Medmenham also needed heroic daredevils who would risk their lives by flying at just 30 meters to capture amazingly detailed close-up images like these.
Low-level black-and-white images of the ground and quarry.
This photograph, the most daring photograph of World War II. Here you can see the dome, but to fly into a quarry and pull up and get a photograph is just amazing.
Made about two runs over it and they opened up on me. And the flak was so damn thick that I was diving, I was doing all sharp turns and everything. I went out the channel and I settled down because I was a little shaken.
There you go, there's the, not quite from the same angle, but it's pretty much the view that the Spitfire got when he flew his very low-level recce. I mean,
with that big dome.
A true dicing sortie, yeah. I mean, here you've got the entire sort of early structure stages here, you know, with obviously all the scaffolding and woodwork going in for the laying of the concrete and so on. Just a huge effort going into building something on the French coast, which was within, you know, reasonable shot of London.
Everybody agreed this is way, way too much effort to be anything but nefarious.
The large domed structure.
And it's too far back from the coast to be part of the defense works.
Then the white building at Medmenham.
The PIs at Medmenham suspected these bunkers were potential rocket launch sites, and they would later be proved to be right.
Major firms in Germany were building them, and they would manufacture the missile, and not only that, but then they had rails outside, places where they could fire the missile.
Adding it to the other heavy sites,
yeah,
and adding it to Peenemünde, put it all together and said, well, safest thing is to bomb this lot into extinction if possible.
Original footage of bombers taking off.
On the 17th and 18th of August 1943, more than 500 bombers set off from the UK with one aim. The complete destruction of Peenemünde and the elimination of the German rocket threat.
They launched the first night precision bombardment raid against Peenemünde.
Air crew were told, if you don't get this, you're going back again. And that's kind of chilling. It certainly underlines the importance of it.
The British were developing a fairly effective bomber force that could, in fact, hit targets at night with pretty good effect.
John Bell was a bomb aimer on a Lancaster bomber.
The whole of the front of the aircraft was my office. You have to line up with a target, look out for the spot flares that you've been told to aim at, and carry out a procedure for bombing, which is fairly automatic once you've lined up the bomb site.
Even though there was heavy flak, even though the Luftwaffe did respond with a certain number of aircraft, the British were able to get in to the target, and they were able to do very severe damage.
Photos of the destruction and fires. Then the old, rusting site now.
There was terrible devastation, an awful loss of life, but we were fighting for our life.
The British bombing raid had in fact thrown the V2 program back at least 8 weeks, maybe more like 12 weeks, but more importantly, had killed several of the most important scientists, and had put the Germans again very firmly on notice that the British knew what they were up to.
Of course, as soon as Peenemünde had been bombed, they had to think about the heavy sites in the Pas-de-Calais, which this was one, wasn't it? So it was decided to bomb all those as well.
We're standing in this area, I think, now, in the,
And
on that photograph, you can still see some remnants of, the construction program, actually, but the dome is complete and hugely thick and effectively bombproof.
Two photos slide together.
This photo shows a German bunker at Watten after conventional saturation bombing by the US Air Force. Amazingly, the building emerged almost unscathed.
The conventional bombs were just bouncing off, and you look at the photography, and the ground around the bunkers are all chewed up, meaning that the bombs hit the bunkers but did no damage. But it soon found out that the bunkers, the only bomb that did any sufficient damage, was the Tallboy.
The 12,000-pound Tallboy and its heavier brother, the Grand Slam, was designed by bouncing bomb legend Barnes Wallace. John Bell dropped one on the bunker at Vizenne.
Tallboy worked very well. It was a very accurate weapon. Quite a pleasure to drop, really. On our aiming at Wizern, all we had to see was a dome sitting on top of a hillside, and that's really what we aimed at. Fortunately, the one I dropped was instrumental in making the dome tilt to one side, but it's perhaps a fortune that we didn't hit it, because otherwise the bomb might well have bounced off.
The near misses did the damage, actually, because they were earthquake effect, and they actually caused the whole site to, you know, sort of tilt a little bit.
We attacked it on several occasions and managed to put it out of action.
RAF Medmenham had dealt a major blow to the German war effort and provided the Nazis with sobering evidence of just how difficult it was to keep their plans veiled from Allied eyes. But Hitler was determined to persevere. The V weapons program was relocated, well beyond the spying lenses of the Spitfire, to the distant forests of Poland, and to the Harz Mountains in the anonymous heartland of Germany itself.
A wide, dark, curving tunnel.
Just outside the small town of Nordhausen, a mountainside was turned into a massive underground factory to produce V weapons.
When you put it underground, first of all, it's devilish hard to bomb, and it's impossible to tell what's going on inside.
The V2 was no mere dabbling in new technology. The Nazis really believed it had the power to swing the outcome of the war, and threw their best minds and resources at it. The ruthless SS, now in charge of the V weapons program, conscripted 60,000 slave laborers to work in infernal darkness in the mountain factory.
I was selected for slave labor. Entering the tunnel, the place was lit up, massive it was. The tunnel was 21 kilometers in total. I immediately thought, good God, we're going to be kept here and we're never going to see daylight again. The dust and the dampness
It was unbelievable. People either lost the will to live or just through the conditions they couldn't cope with it and they perished. There were dead bodies lying all over.
The human tragedy unfolding in the mountains and at the Dora concentration camp was not evident to the PIs at Medmenham. Even if it had been, not even the tall boy could have made a difference.
Modern film of a Spitfire flying.
The V weapons could no longer be destroyed at source. Now the only solution lay in finding and wiping out their launch sites in northern France. A first lead came from the French resistance, which warned of a lot of clandestine German building.
The information that was being provided by the French resistance was extremely good. They were picking out areas in which Germans had kept people from going into the particular area. That was a good sign that something secretly was going on.
This time, the spy planes would have to look a lot harder to find their targets.
The only thing you could really see was a ramp, and they put them in these little groups of woods. I think the first time I spent a half hour before I finally caught on how I could see them, and then after that it got easier, but they were still very, very difficult to spot.
RAF Medmenham, 4th of November 1943.
What the PIs saw through their stereoscopes was perplexing. Woods full of new buildings, all of weird shapes and sizes. As well as the ramps, there were buildings that looked like skis turned on their side. So they became known as the ski sites.
Looking at it from the air is one thing, but actually ground checking it is fascinating.
Nobody could imagine what on earth you would build a building this shape for.
In all, 96 sites, all almost identical, were identified by Medmenham.
I mean, when these were first seen, they were a complete mystery. Nobody actually knew what they were or what they were for. And this has got the classic ski structure signatures on it, which became, of course, the giveaway.
Yeah, looking at these photographs makes you realise what a challenge it was for the PIs at that time. There was a lot of searching in the dark, you might say.
1st of December 1943.
The problem the PIs faced was that a vital piece of the jigsaw was missing. They still knew nothing about the existence of the V1 flying bomb. It was not discovered until late 1943 on a photograph of Peenemünde. To the untrained eye, it looked like nothing at all.
You could see it was some sort of flying vehicle. But what sort of a flying vehicle? A lot of work was involved in inferring from what could be seen, from measurements, from experience, from thinking, then of what it could be and what it could do.
Whisper went round the whole station, so we're all very well aware that this was something absolutely fantastically important.
It's just a small blur, really. It's just a tiny cruciform shape sitting on a ramp, very, very similar to the ramp over there. And that then, with the ramp and the sights they'd already witnessed, began to put the story together. And they realised that the threat was almost certainly a small pilotless aircraft, almost certainly a bomb, of course.
It took a great leap of the imagination from the PIs to identify a blurred cross as a flying bomb. Using computer graphics, we can reveal what they saw. A deadly V1 poised to be fired.
The small, plane-like bomb sits at the bottom of a long metal ramp.
The mysterious ski-shaped buildings turned out to be V1 storerooms.
Suddenly, all those strange structures in France meant something. Now they knew those were the ramps that were going to launch the V1s. They plotted the ramps, and they could see exactly where the V1s were headed. Southampton, Portsmouth, London.
Thanks to the Wilt machine, it was clear the Nazis were on the verge of launching a devastating bombardment of the south of England. The timing could not have been worse for the Allies, who were in the midst of plans to invade France.
They were planning on the D-Day landings, and how was this going to affect those plans?
The Germans had planned to launch up to 2,000 V-1s a day.
If you could have had a couple of those V-1s hit a troop ship.
It was vital that they attacked them and wiped them out. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been possible to invade.
A plane's loaded with bombs.
This prompted the Allies to launch Operation Crossbow at the end of 1943. Its success could determine the outcome of the whole war. Bombing the ski sites became a priority. It began 2 days before Christmas.
A map graphic shows the locations. Old film, the actual explosions.
The heaviest bombing I ever saw. You couldn't see much of anything. There were so many craters.
It hadn't destroyed those sites. It's hard to tell what would have happened to the Normandy invasion. It would have probably had them been put off.
There's no doubt at all that the intensive bombing of the V-1 sites must have prevented a substantial part of the intended attack from ever arriving. It was vital to the mounting of the invasion.
Now the biggest thing for Medmenham was to plan the invasion of Europe. This was a fantastic effort. Hundreds of daily flights, monitoring all the activities.
On the Normandy landings, every platoon commander had photographs of where he was landing, where the mines were and where the obstacles were. Everything was known.
Guided by Medmenham, Operation Overlord was launched on June the 6th, 1944. And the feared German missiles did not rain down on the Allies' parade.
Film of the beach landing.
But that particular nightmare had been merely postponed. What came next made it dramatically clear how important it had been for D-Day to happen on schedule.
The first V-1 landed on London a week after we were ashore in Normandy.
A building collapses in the city, and firemen hose down the rubble.
The V-1 brought terror to the streets of London, and soon became known as the Doodlebug, because of the sinister sound it made.
They went pop, 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 then suddenly stop, and you hoped that you weren't under or anywhere near where it was going to drop.
One falls from the sky. A plume of smoke rises over London.
Eileen Alexander was 11 when she heard that terrifying sound overhead near her East London home. Her ordeal that day made her national news.
There was a big explosion. I was knocked from the door right to the end of the shelter, and I was really badly bruised, head to toe. It was really dark and black. You couldn't see anything. And I was very frightened. When it cleared a little bit, I saw the devastation. My house had gone. So I was crying then. And then a fireman came along. We'd lost everything, but we didn't lose our lives.
As the death toll mounted into the thousands, the British fought back against these unmanned killing machines in any way they could.
A ground barrage shoots one out of the sky. A plane attacks another.
RAF Medmenham played its part by uncovering the source of these terror weapons. It was a real game of cat and mouse. Every time they were caught out, the Germans had an uncanny knack of finding a new way of doing things.
A different aerial photograph.
Now they were using less conspicuous launch areas. An artful camouflage to hide their V1 operations.
They developed very small sites, and they would bring the missiles literally at the last possible minute, set up the missile, fuel it, launch it, and get out of there.
The 3D photos again came into their own as the PIs looked for a needle in a haystack.
These were much, much harder to find. This is an example in Holland. It's at a sugar factory. And the signatures that give away the site are actually very tentative. There is scarring on the land. There is damage on a building roof.
Small black marks.
And the ramp, it's almost impossible to see, is here, just tucked inside the building.
You see that pattern we've got there, yeah, of those scarrings were not something that's normal at all.
This shows the V1 taking off the ramp, and the booster motor and the dolly that supported it are dropping off.
So that's what we're seeing.
That's what you're seeing here, causing scarring, yeah.
Under the direction of Medmenham, Allied bombers were able to target these sites and limit the Doodlebug barrage against London. This gave the ground forces time to sweep up the V1 emplacements as they fought their way across northern France. But the Germans were not finished yet. An even greater threat lay waiting in the wings.
We just thought, what next? Because this was a new kind of thing, you know, rockets and so on. Hitler was capable of anything.
The last Doodlebug fell on the 7th of September, 1944, and the Battle of London was declared over. Just one day later, the unimaginable happened. The first V2 rocket crashed into Chiswick in West London. What made it so terrifying was that it travelled at supersonic speed and came out of nowhere with no warning.
The defences against the V1 was possible. There was no defence against the V2. Once they fired, they're gone.
The notion that you could be blown up by something before you even knew it was coming was always a bit of a humming.
I was probably the first to see a V2 going up. I was on my way to a target, and suddenly through the cloud came a vertical contrail. And I thought, hey, that's funny. And I thought it must be a rocket. I tried to take a photograph of this contrail, but I failed. When I got back to base, I reported this, of course, but nobody else believed it, and it was called Taylor's Folly.
Taylor's Folly was Medmenham's worst nightmare.
This was a major problem because the V2 was mobile. So you fly and you see, dash, here it is, here's one, and you photograph it.
All they did was pour a big concrete slab, and the trucks would come and they'd erect the rocket itself and refuel it sitting on this concrete pad.
A huge rocket takes off in the trees.
And then they'd fire it and drive off.
The whole thing about the missile system was shoot and scoot.
So Medmenham needed to find ways of containing the threat of the V2.
Here's the famous V2.
One hangs in a museum.
What RAF Medmenham did at the time, they looked at the whole production facility in the Harz Mountains, and they attacked the transport system, the type of vehicles they were using, and all the supporting infrastructure that supported the V2, which made it incredibly difficult challenge.
The only way to stop the V2 in the end was the army to overrun the launch sites, which is what they did in the end.
By the time it went operational, forces on the ground had almost pushed it out of range of the major targets.
Another V2 launches.
The V weapons claimed about 9,000 lives in England, but it could have been so many more had it not been for Medmenham. The PIs had been proved right. Those mysterious tubes and ramps at Peenemünde had indeed presaged an entirely new era of warfare that could easily have rained untold destruction down on England.
It saved London from total obliteration.
The V2 was a testament to German ingenuity. And as soon as the war was over, the Americans and the Soviets rushed to grab their technology.
We looked upon the Germans as great scientists, and they were. They provided us a lot of information.
The key figure in the development of the V2, Wernher von Braun, went on to become the architect of Saturn V, which took man to the moon.
Von Braun, he should have been tried as a war criminal. And everybody who run the Dora camp, they were using slave labor, us, who were really brought down to animal level.
The V2 was also built on German barbarism, as was clear when Dora was liberated.
The dead were stacked like cordwood. Thousands of dead people were there that were the Dora inmates. They weren't burying the dead. They were just stacking them outside the underground.
We were robbed of our future, of our youth. It's just unbelievable what we as humans are able to do to each other.
The appalling scenes at Dora were yet more proof of the kind of war the PIs at Medmenham and the spy planes helped to win.
Victims are loaded onto a truck. Today at Medmenham.
70 years on, and veterans from Medmenham are holding a reunion at Danesfield House.
He's going to die for us.
They may not have achieved the celebrity and recognition of their intelligence colleagues at Bletchley Park. The reconnaissance pilots lack the glamour of the fighter boys of the Battle of Britain. But their unsung contribution to the war was as important as either.
Without the unique qualities of the people who worked there, we would have been far worse off. I think the war would have been extended by a year or two. They made a huge contribution.
I always felt, when the war was over and I was demobbed, in a very small way, I contributed something of value to the war effort.
People were doing it for the sake of the job and because the job was worthwhile and because it was exciting and valuable and you could see the point of it.
I feel we did a useful job and helped to shorten the war.
I just like being my own boss. I like doing my own thing. If it goofed up, I was the one that goofed up. It meant so much to me. It meant so much the rest of my life. And I loved it.
In the Spitfire's hangar.
This is a wonderful aeroplane. And it still is really the love of my life. And it's not really a war machine because photographs can't do any harm to anybody until we drop bombs on the Germans as a result of these photographs, which, of course, in the end, won us the war.